So we have been in a series of sermons, which is a systematic study of Bible doctrine, and we have been talking about the doctrine of God and what the Bible teaches about God. We are particularly, over the last few messages, have been looking at God's will, His sovereign control over all things. And so we are continuing. This will be message number 12 in this total series. And the title is God's Will and Real Life. God's Will and Real Life. So we'll be looking at, starting here in Deuteronomy chapter number 9, and be reading verses 1 to 5. Hear, O Israel, thou art to pass over Jordan this day, to go in to possess nations greater and mightier than thyself, cities great and fenced up to heaven, a people great and tall, the children of the Anakims, whom thou knowest and of whom thou hast heard say, who can stand before the children of Anak. Understand therefore this day that the Lord thy God is he which goeth over before thee. As a consuming fire he shall destroy them, and he shall bring them down before thy face. So shalt thou drive them out, and destroy them quickly, as the Lord hath said unto thee. Speak not thou in thine heart after that the Lord thy God hath cast them out from before thee, saying, For my righteousness the Lord hath brought me in to possess this land. But for the wickedness of these nations the Lord doth drive them out from before thee. Not for thy righteousness, or for the uprightness of thine heart, dost thou go to possess their land. But for the wickedness of these nations, the Lord thy God doth drive them out from before thee, and that he may perform the word which the Lord sware unto thy fathers, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. So why do gamblers lose? Well, some would say that it's just because they're unlucky, or maybe they're inexperienced, you know, they don't really know what they're doing. Or maybe that the universe is just against them, out to get them for some reason. Well, Vern Poitras would say that it's because they're not very good at math. Vern Poitras is a rare combination of a mathematician and a theologian. He holds a BS in mathematics from Caltech and a PhD in mathematics from Harvard, along with a number of other master's and doctorate degrees from various seminaries in theology. And he wrote a book entitled Chance and the Sovereignty of God, and there he takes a mathematical and a theological approach to the question of chance and such. And I highly recommend that book, although there is some math, and that may scare you off from it. But if you are really interested in that, that is an excellent book. But Poitras describes in that book the principle of probabilistic independence. And don't go to sleep on me. We're not going to fall into a college lecture or anything. It just simply refers to the outcome or the activities that produce a free and independent outcome. All right. So like the roll of dice or the spinning of a roulette wheel. Or the flip of a coin. Now, this, of course, is assuming that everything is on the up and up and that the flip of the coin or the dice that are rolled or the wheel that is spun isn't loaded, it isn't rigged in some way, so it's truly a free and independent outcome. And in a free roll of dice, for instance, each roll is independent of the previous roll. Doesn't matter what that previous roll was. The next roll is independent of that. So the previous roll, in other words, has zero effect on the outcome of the next roll. You roll a dice, you get a six. That means absolutely nothing for what the next roll is going to be. That's probabilistic independence. And it's probably easiest actually to illustrate this with coin flips because you've only got two sides, two possible outcomes. It's just a lot simpler. All right, so the Super Bowl is the annual NFL championship game, for anyone that doesn't know that. It happens once a year. It is one of the most popular events of all sports, of all sorts of gambling on sports. And everything in the Super Bowl, all kinds of things, people place bets on. One of the most popular, though, is the coin toss that starts the game. So they flip a coin to decide, you know, who the team gets to decide whether they're going to receive or whether they're going to defend, or and they're, you know, heads or tails is the way that it's decided. So to this point, there have been 55 Super Bowls. That means there's been 55 coin tosses to start the game. The results have been tails 29 times and heads 26 times. Now, it would seem from those results that tails would probably be the safest bet. Seems like it's got a slight edge over heads. Well, let's consider the streaks, though. Because any time that you roll a dice or you flip a coin, there are certain streaks when you get the same result over and over in a row for a certain amount of time. So if we would consider a streak of coin tosses as being any time that you get the same result three times or more, then let's consider what's happened in these Super Bowl coin flips. So here are the streaks. It has been heads three times from 1972 to 1974. It was heads three times in a row from 78 to 80. Heads four times in a row from 90 to 93. And heads five times in a row, which is the longest streak that's happened in the coin tosses, from 2009 to 2013. Well, what about tails? Well, there's been streaks of it being tails three times from 1981 to 1983. Three times from 85 to 87. Four times from 98 to 2001. Four times from 2003 to 2006, and also a streak of four times from 2014 to 2017. Well, if we look at the streaks and we look at the flips, we realize that they come out about the same. There's a slight advantage to tails. So the streaks would seem to suggest that the safest bet would be the same result the third time. In other words, any time that you have two consecutive results, the safest bet would be for the same result that third time. Now, assuming, of course, that the coin is properly balanced, that it's unaltered in any way, it truly is a free flip, that it goes up and it lands, a coin's a pretty simple object. It has two sides, heads or tails. And flipping a coin yields one of two results every single time. So over a long series of flips, the results will tend to be, this should be no surprise, 50% heads and 50% tails. And they've actually done scientific studies, flipping coins thousands of times, recording the outcomes, and the more times that the coin is flipped, the more it tends toward 50%. So even if you try that on your own, you're going to get close to 50%. Now, even if you have a streak and you get a whole lot of heads or a whole lot of tails in a row, the next flip, let's say you've got 13 of them in a row, the very next flip still has a 1 in 2 chance of being heads and a 1 in 2 chance of being tails. So if we think about the Super Bowl results, we find that out of 55 flips, it's been heads 26 times and tails 29 times. That is heads 47% of the time, tails about 53% of the time. That's about half, and that's what it will continue to be. And if they keep having Super Bowls on and on and on and on, then the more flips that are added, those numbers are just simply going to continue to slowly creep closer toward 50%. This is where gamblers lose, because they bet on streaks and such. In other words, they think that they see a pattern and they have a feeling, or they think that something is due. It has been heads five times in a row, so surely that next flip is going to be tails. Or some will take the other approach. No. This is a streak. We've got to ride this streak. It's going to come up heads again. But each flip is independent of all the previous flips. Does not matter what those previous flips were, has absolutely nothing to do with what this coin is going to be the next time then I flip it. So in terms of probability, heads is no more likely because of the previous flips, and tails is no more likely or less likely, even if the previous flips have seemed to favor one or the other. Well, is this what we're talking about? Is this fatalism? Is this fatalism? Now, that's also what many people think when we talk about God's will and His sovereign control over all things. Well, this is just fatalism. Well, fatalism is the embrace of what we might describe as a true randomness, a true chance. It's what atheist Richard Dawkins once called nothing but pitiless indifference. Now, Poythress does a good job in his book explaining why there is actually no such thing as what we call chance and true randomness. We have the perception of it, but not the reality of it. He actually proves that from a mathematical standpoint as well as a theological one. And again, if you're really interested in that, I recommend that you read that. But here's the thing. The Bible does not teach fatalism, that outcomes are nothing but pitiless indifference. The Bible does not teach that. Rather, the Bible teaches that all things are willed by God, and that all things are under His control, and that all things happen according to His own purpose from before the foundation of the world. And that would include even the toss of the coin before a Super Bowl game. Proverbs chapter 16 and verse 33 says, "The lot is cast into the lap, but the whole disposing thereof is of the Lord." In other words, men may cast lots for sport, or they may cast lots for decisions, but the outcome is determined by the Lord. Well, this brings us to consider what we've been studying about God's will, and what we might call the intersection of God's will and human desires and human choices and human actions. In other words, oftentimes this is put as the problem of God's sovereignty and human responsibility. Well, God's will, or His decree, is His eternal purpose of all things that come to pass in heaven and on earth. And there's various terms that refer to this in the Bible: will, counsel, purpose, decree, determinate counsel, eternal purpose, pleasure, foreknowledge, foreordination, and so on. We've looked a lot in Ephesians chapter number 1, and particularly at verse number 11, how that it teaches these crucial truths about God's will, that His will is singular. His will is a single, unified, overarching will that encompasses all things. All of these various individual events all together are controlled by His single will. So whatever comes to pass, whether it comes to pass by an act of cause, whether it comes to pass by a permission, it comes to pass according to His will and for His purpose. And we've already talked about how that's inescapable from the fact that God has a absolute and perfect foreknowledge of all things. And we've looked at a number of passages of Scripture relating to that. We also saw in Ephesians 1 how that God's will is from eternity. In other words, it's from before the foundation of the world. God is not watching events unfold on the earth and then determining what to do, or determining how, maybe, if you have a rat, you know, that's running in one of those little mazes, and you're trying to, maybe you're nudging it, it's going the wrong way, trying to nudge it back in the right way. God's not in heaven nudging things on the earth this way and that way, trying, you know, I want to get here, things seem to be going here, let's give it a little nudge and get going back in that direction. That is not at all what the Bible tells us about God's will. No, God's will is complete. From before the foundation of the world, before He ever created this earth, any of us ever even existed. So we are, as we're told in Ephesians 1, predestinated, Paul says, according to His purpose that was purposed before the foundation of the world. And before the creation, that foundation of the world, only God existed, only God in three persons. We haven't really gotten to the Trinity yet, but we'll get there as we continue on in this study. So it's God's will. It's God's own will, as Ephesians 1:11 tells us. He works all things according to the counsel of His own will. So God wills independent of any outside influence or condition or control. So, in our text here in Deuteronomy chapter 9, God is speaking to Israel through Moses, and He's telling them that they are to understand, they're about to go into the promised land. This is after the 40 years of wandering in the wilderness because of their unbelief and rebellion. They're going to enter into the promised land. Moses is preparing them here in the book of Deuteronomy to enter into that land. And He's telling them that they are to understand that God has brought them into this promised land according to His will and not according to their righteousness or their merit. In other words, they are not to think that God has looked down from heaven, has seen this people of Israel suffering in Egypt, decided, you know what, I'm going to do something about that, and He gets them out of Egypt. They have a lot of trouble and things along the way. And then God decides, you know what? They're doing pretty good now. They're on a good track. They're on a good path. They're back in my favor. So now I'm going to bring them into the promised land. Moses is telling them here very plainly not to think that. That is not why you are entering this land. That is not why you are going to possess this land. In fact, in verse 5, He's telling them that He had purposed to bring them into this land and to drive out the inhabitants of the land in front of them through judgment on them before any of them, Moses included, were ever even born. Over 400 years prior to this, God revealed this purpose to Abraham. He says in verse 5, "Not for thy righteousness or for the uprightness of thine heart dost thou go to possess their land, but for the wickedness of these nations, the Lord thy God doth drive them out from before thee, and that He may perform the word which the Lord sware unto thy fathers, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob." God first revealed this to Abraham, later affirming it to Isaac and to Jacob. So this is all according to God's will that was revealed in what is said here in verse 5, the word that the Lord sware unto thy fathers. This word to Abraham. So in Genesis chapter 15, verses 13 to 16, God speaking unto Abraham, "Know of a surety that thy seed shall be a stranger in a land that is not theirs, and shall serve them, and they shall afflict them 400 years." Of course, now we know that that was Egypt. "And also that nation whom they shall serve will I judge. And afterward they shall come out with great substance. And thou shalt go to thy fathers in peace. Thou shalt be buried in a good old age. But in the fourth generation they shall come hither again." And notice this, "For the iniquity of the Amorites is not yet full." So God had a purpose that He revealed to Abraham over 400 years before Moses was speaking these words to Israel concerning everyone that was involved there, that they're going to go into this land and they're going to drive out these nations. This was fulfilled. Exodus chapter 12, verses 40 to 41. "Now the sojourning of the children of Israel who dwelt in Egypt was 430 years. And it came to pass at the end of 430 years, even the selfsame day it came to pass, that all the hosts of the Lord went out from the land of Egypt," just as He had revealed to Abraham 400 years before. So this word that was spoken to Abraham, dabar in the Hebrew, and it means a matter spoken or stated. In other words, it doesn't refer to the method of communication. It rather refers to the substance of what is communicated. It's a word that is translated to speak of commandments, of counsels, of decrees, of judgments, of purposes. In other words, this is God's word to Abraham. God is revealing to Abraham beforehand what He has willed to be, what He has willed to come to pass. That word came to pass just as He foretold. So God willed a certain end. And he also willed the means to that end. The word to Abraham involved not only Israel inhabiting the land, it involved also the judgment of the Amorites or the Canaanites, and it also involved their sojourn as strangers for four generations in Egypt. Well, this obviously touches on the principle that we have already looked at, the principle of that I call the ascendant purposes, or that there are lesser and greater purposes, that in any single event, God may be working in various ways to accomplish various levels of His purposes toward His ultimate end goal, which of course is that He be most glorified. We talked about that from Ephesians 1 as well as other places. Okay, so between Abraham and Moses, we see the promise came to Abraham. It's revealed to Abraham what's going to happen. We see it unfold and happen. And now Moses is referring back to it, that this has all been by God's purpose, that was from before the foundation of the world, but he revealed it to Abraham over 400 years ago. And this is all coming about according to his will, not according to the good leadership of Moses, not according to the righteousness of the Israelites, not according to their prowess as warriors that they're going to be able to go in and conquer this land, but it's happening according to his purpose that he revealed to Abraham over 400 years before. So in between Abraham and Moses, we actually have a profound illustration that teaches us a lot about God's will and human responsibility, and that is in the life of Joseph. So, what we are going to look at is, first of all, the highlights of Joseph's life. We want to just get sort of a sketch. We want to get an outline of Joseph's life, which is given to us in Genesis chapters 37 to 50. And then, secondly, we want to see God's will in the details, remembering that he had revealed to Abraham all that was going to come to pass, and we're seeing it unfolding and happening in the life of Joseph particularly. So Joseph was born the 11th son. If you want to turn to Genesis, you can go to Genesis 37, but we'll probably look at a few verses here along the way. Genesis 37 is where we are introduced to Joseph. So Joseph was born the 11th son to Jacob, and Jacob was the heir to the promise from Isaac and from Abraham. Jacob had 12 sons by four different women, Joseph being the firstborn of Rachel, which was Jacob's most loved wife. Joseph was favored by Jacob, his father, and he was hated by his brothers. And his brothers wanted to kill him, and mainly due to the favoritism that his father showed him. They ultimately sold Joseph as a slave to those traveling to Egypt. He ended up in Potiphar's house. And through the treachery of Potiphar's wife, he ended up going to prison. Joseph was brought out of prison in order to interpret Pharaoh's dreams. And after he did so, he was actually made a governor over all of Egypt, second in command under the Pharaoh himself. Joseph was finally reunited with his family in Egypt after some years, where they remained for four generations until God brought them out through bringing judgment on Egypt. So this account of Joseph, which again runs from Genesis 37 to Genesis 50, it takes up a good portion of the account of the patriarchs in this book, the patriarchs being Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And really the story of the patriarchs and that beginning, that origin of the nation of Israel begins in Genesis chapter 12. So the story of the patriarchs is the majority of the book from chapter 12 to chapter 50. And the account of Joseph, it takes up a considerable portion of this account of the patriarchs. And the events in Joseph's life are obviously revealed and even narrated as being crucial to the unfolding of God's purpose that He had revealed to Abraham. So that brings us then to look at God's will in the details of Joseph's life, not just the general outline or the general trajectory. So when we think about, again, this prophecy that was given to Joseph's great-grandfather, his great-grandfather Abraham, God revealed to Abraham that Israel, as a people, would be in a strange land, again, that we now know is Egypt, for four generations. We read those verses in Genesis 15. But how and when that was to come about was not revealed. In other words, how Abraham came to this land, because you remember that God called Abraham out of Ur of the Chaldees. And He brought him into this land at points, telling him as far as he could look and see that this land was going to be his and to his seed after him and all of these things. And now He's telling Abraham that this seed, this nation that God has promised to raise up from Abraham is actually going to go out of the promised land and are going to stay in a strange country among strange people and be afflicted for four generations. How that's going to happen, He doesn't tell us. He doesn't tell Abraham. We don't know. When exactly that's going to happen, He doesn't tell us. Joseph was 17 years old in Genesis chapter 37, and he received a vision in two dreams. So this is in verses 5 to 11. And Joseph dreamed a dream, and he told it his brethren, and they hated him yet the more. And he said unto them, "Hear, I pray you, this dream which I have dreamed. For behold, we were binding sheaves in the field. And lo, my sheaf arose and also stood upright. And behold, your sheaves stood round about and made obeisance to my sheaf." And his brothers said to him, "Shalt thou indeed reign over us? Or shalt thou indeed have dominion over us?" And they hated him yet the more for his dreams and for his words. And he dreamed yet another dream and told it his brethren and said, "Behold, I have dreamed a dream more. And behold, the sun and the moon and the 11 stars made obeisance to me." And he told it to his father and to his brethren. And his father rebuked him and said unto him, "What is this dream that thou hast dreamed? Shall I and thy mother and thy brethren indeed come to bow down ourselves to thee to the earth?" And his brethren envied him, but his father observed the saying. 17 years old, Joseph receives two visions in dreams from God. Both visions essentially saying the same thing. That Joseph is going to be exalted above his brothers, above even his father and his mother in some way. Now, this exaltation above his family, much like what was revealed to Abraham about his seed sojourning in the land of Egypt, is not said how that's going to come about. In other words, this vision did not give Joseph any particular directions. It simply gave him a glimpse through a symbolic vision of something that was going to come to pass. Didn't say how, didn't say when. So what is Joseph to do? In other words, how is Joseph to live his life? Is he to live his life to try to make this come about? Is he to live his life in some way, always angling toward trying to get to some exalted position over his family? Well, this obviously then speaks of human responsibility in the light of God's will and sovereignty. I mean, God has revealed this to Joseph. Surely it's going to come to pass, but how, he doesn't know. Well, our responsibility, just as it was with Joseph, is always to do what God has commanded us to do. Our responsibility is never told to us to be, try to figure out what God has decreed, and then go and try to make that happen. That's never our responsibility. Again, Deuteronomy 29:29, "The secret things belong unto the Lord our God, but those things which are revealed belong unto us," meaning His Word, "and to our children forever, that we may do all the words of this law." So as we study Joseph's life as it proceeds from here to the end of the book of Genesis, we see that Joseph is not trying to get to Egypt. Joseph is not sitting around thinking, well, now, great-grandpa Abraham was told that his descendants were going to spend four generations in a foreign land outside of this land that he had promised to give them. So what do I need to do in order to get our people into this foreign land? What do I need to do in order to become a governor and to be exalted and have power and position and authority over all? How do I need to get all of that to come about? Well, Joseph doesn't do that. First of all, he doesn't even know that Egypt is the place that he's supposed to be. He has no idea that that's where he's going to go. He doesn't know that's what God has willed for him and for Israel. So after Jacob, what we find of Joseph is him simply being faithful to do what is his to do. He's serving his father. He's helping his father and his family with the flocks and such. And Jacob gives this coat to Joseph, this coat of many collars. Most likely was indicative of the fact that Jacob had actually made him some sort of a manager, some sort of a steward. But nevertheless, he gives him this coat. Joseph tells his brothers and his family this dreams that he's had, and they are so angered and enraged that they want to kill their own brother. So they leave with the flocks. And what happens? Well, here later in chapter 37, Joseph is sent to find them. He is sent to go and to bring back an account of his brothers and the flocks of Jacob that they have taken out to pasture. So Joseph goes to Shechem to find them because that's where they were going to set out for. But they're not in Shechem. He doesn't find them there. So what's Joseph to do? Well, here in verse number 12, it says, "And his brethren went to feed their father's flock in Shechem. And Israel said unto Joseph, Do not thy brethren feed the flock in Shechem. Come, and I will send thee unto them. And he saith to him, Here am I. And he said unto him, Go, I pray thee, see whether it be well with thy brethren and well with the flocks, and bring me word again. So he sent him out to the vale of Hebron, and he came to Shechem. And a certain man found him, and behold, he was wandering in the field. And the man asked him, saying, What seekest thou? And he said, I seek my brethren. Tell me, I pray thee, where they feed their flocks. And the man said, They are departed hence, for I heard them say, Let us go to Dothan. And Joseph went after his brethren and found them in Dothan. So a man, just some man, some random man, happens to find Joseph. He goes to Shechem, where his brothers are supposed to be. They're not there. He has no way. He can't check. He can't track them on Apple Maps or look up on Facebook and see where they've checked in lately. He doesn't know where they are. He doesn't know how to find them. Some man just happens to be there, happens to know who Joseph's brothers are, happens to know where they went. And he tells Joseph that. Again, this is not Joseph contriving to do anything. He's simply trying to be faithful. How important is it that Joseph makes it to Dothan? Well, that is where Joseph ends up being sold into slavery by his brothers. Crucial to this account. As we know this whole story, this is crucial to the people of Israel ending up in Egypt. And Joseph is not trying to make this happen. He's not trying to contrive it. He's faithfully serving his father. And so he goes to Dothan. Well, the brothers wanted to kill him, we're told in chapter 37. Verses 18 to 28, as they're deliberating about that. Reuben, the eldest of the brothers, he talks them out of it. Then later Judah, another one of the brothers, convinces them to sell him as a slave. Let's not kill him. Let's sell him as a slave. So they sold him to this traveling band of Ishmaelites, again here in chapter 37, verses 25 to 28. And where were those Ishmaelites headed? They were headed for Egypt, is where they were headed. And so that is where Joseph ends up in Egypt. Again, not by his contrivance. In fact, he has fallen into the hands of his brothers. He's not making any decisions about where he's going and what happens to him next. He's thrown into this pit, and then later he is pulled up and he is sold to the Ishmaelites, who take him to Egypt. He ends up being sold there to Potiphar, a captain there to Pharaoh. And he ends up being put over Potiphar's house. Why? Joseph is a slave. But yet what we learn about him is that Joseph is always faithful where he's at. He's always faithful with whatever the circumstances, whatever the conditions are. He's not contriving to try to do anything. He simply is being faithful. Joseph is presented to us as a character of faith. He is a man of integrity. He is a man who obviously has been given a lot of wisdom and a lot of skill in matters of management and stewardship and such. And no matter where he is, that just seems to come out and it seems to shine. Joseph ends up being promoted within Potiphar's house. He's the head slave. That may not sound so glorious, but I imagine being the head slave is better than being the least slave. And he ends up being over all of Potiphar's affairs. Well, of course, then we know what happens with Potiphar's wife and the lies, her treachery as she tries to entangle and ensnare him and ultimately lies about him, and Joseph ends up in prison. Joseph wasn't trying to go to prison. Joseph was just doing his job and also avoiding sinning against God, and he ends up in prison. Well, when he's in prison, Pharaoh's butler and his baker are put into prison. Joseph didn't make that happen. He had nothing to do with that. These are people who had access to Pharaoh personally that are put in the same prison with Joseph. And again, he didn't contrive that. Abraham didn't set that up. Jacob didn't make that happen. None of that was under any of their control, nor did they even understand or understood what it meant. Obviously, these things, as Moses was telling the people of Israel, these things come about according to God's purpose. These things come about according to God's will. There is a master orchestrator that has a design and a plan and a purpose over all things. And these things are simply happening and are just falling right into place to end up exactly as it needs to be, as God has purposed and revealed to Abraham. Well, the butler and the baker end up in prison. And of course, if you're familiar with the tale, they have dreams where they receive visions, which are prophecies about what is about to happen to them. That's in chapter 40. And it takes up a good bit of that chapter, verses 5 to 23. And of course, Joseph interprets their dreams. And just as Joseph gave the interpretation, those things come to pass. 2 years pass. And Pharaoh, Joseph's still in prison, and Pharaoh himself has a dream this time. And he calls all of his important people to try to interpret this dream and to tell him what it means, and they can't. And then it's at just such a time that Pharaoh's butler remembers this Hebrew in the prison who had interpreted dreams, and the interpretations came to pass exactly as he had said, and he tells Pharaoh about him. Of course, Joseph had interpreted the dreams of what God has decreed, and those dreams are fulfilled exactly. He speaks to Pharaoh, he gives the interpretation at 30 years old now. At 30 years old, Joseph is made governor over Egypt. He is put in the highest position in the land, second only to Pharaoh himself. And then, of course, there are 7 good years, just as Joseph had said from the interpretation of the dream. And then the 7 years of famine start. Joseph didn't make good years. Joseph didn't make a famine. Joseph didn't make himself governor over Egypt. That's where he ended up, through being faithful, but overall because there was a master designer over these events in Joseph's life. And of course, by the time you get to chapter 42, lo and behold, Joseph's brothers come to Egypt because the famine has been so severe. And through Joseph's management and his wisdom and his stewardship and his faithfulness, there's a store and a supply of food in Egypt in order to weather these 7 years of famine. And so Joseph's brothers come to buy food. And of course, when they first see him in chapter 42 and verse number 6, what do? But they bow down before him. They receive rough treatment. And when they're treated roughly, even though many years have passed, when they're treated roughly, what do they think about it? They assume that it's because of their sins and that this is from the hand of God. So in chapter 42 and verse number 21, they said one to another, "We are verily guilty concerning our brother, in that we saw the anguish of his soul when he besought us and we would not hear. Therefore is this distress come upon us." In verse 28, he said unto his brethren, "My money is restored, and lo, it is even in my sack." And their heart failed them, and they were afraid, saying one to another, "What is this that God hath done unto us?" And of course, when Jacob receives the report about the cup and Benjamin and all of that, what does he say at the end of chapter 42? "Jacob, their father, said unto them, Me have ye bereaved of my children. Joseph is not, and Simeon is not, and ye will take Benjamin away? All these things are against me." That was the conclusion that Jacob came to. Of course, we know that it's exactly the opposite. All of these things are for him, though they were actually causing him quite a bit of distress. So after 2 years of bad famine, Jacob consents. Oh, they can send Benjamin. The brothers, they see some design in this event. In other words, they recognize early on that this is not just a coincidence. These events that are happening. And in chapter 44 and verse number 16, Judah said, "What shall we say unto my Lord? What shall we speak? Or how shall we clear ourselves? God hath found out the iniquity of thy servants. Behold, we are my Lord's servants, both we and he also with whom the cup is found." Speaking, of course, of Benjamin and the cup in his sack. So Judah then seeks to sacrifice himself for his brother Benjamin. And then Joseph reveals himself to them, and he interprets God's will. Here in chapter 45, verses 5 to 8. "Now therefore be not grieved nor angry with yourselves that you sold me hither. For God did send me before you to preserve life." Now you think about all the things that have happened to Joseph up to this point. And here are his brothers, the ones who committed such a treacherous, unthinkable act as to want to kill him, but to stop just short. For some reason, it seemed like they were restrained, and they didn't kill him like they really wanted to, and instead they sold him into slavery. And here they are before him, and Joseph is obviously the most powerful man in Egypt, second only to the Pharaoh, and he can do whatever he wants to them. But Joseph says, "God sent me before you to preserve life. For these 2 years hath the famine been in the land, and yet there are 5 years in which there shall neither be earing nor harvest. And God sent me before you to preserve you a posterity in the earth, and to save your lives by great deliverance. So now it was not you that hath sent me hither, but God. And he hath made me a father to Pharaoh and lord of all his house, and a ruler throughout all the land of Egypt." So Joseph recognized that this has all come about according to God's will. So we know the story. Jacob and the rest of his family come on down to Egypt, spend the rest of Jacob's life there. And then once he dies, his brothers are once again worried and they are afraid of what Joseph might do to them. But Joseph allays their fears. So now we look at chapter 50 in verse 14. "And Joseph returned into Egypt, he and his brethren, and all that went up with him to bury his father after he had buried his father. And when Joseph's brethren saw that their father was dead, they said, Joseph will peradventure hate us, and will certainly requite us all the evil which we did unto him. And they sent a messenger unto Joseph, saying, Thy father did command before he died, saying, So shall you say unto Joseph, Forgive, I pray thee now, the trespass of thy brethren and their sin, for they did unto thee evil. And now we pray thee, forgive the trespass of the servants of the God of thy father. And Joseph wept when they spake unto him. And his brothers also went and fell down before his face, and they said, Behold, we be thy servants. And Joseph said unto them, Fear not, for am I in the place of God? But as for you, ye thought evil against me, but God meant it unto good to bring to pass, as it is this day, to save much people alive. Now therefore, fear ye not, I will nourish you and your little ones. And he comforted them and spake kindly unto them. So Joseph did not deny that his brothers had done evil, that they had purposed evil, that they had meant evil. He says, but God meant it for good. He recognized a higher and a greater purpose, even in the evil that he had suffered. So what is Joseph saying? He's saying that they are responsible. He says, am I in the place of God? And what Joseph is saying simply is that, am I in the place of God to judge you? Am I in the place of God to bring judgment on you for your actions? No, that's God's place, and he will judge you accordingly. They were responsible. God was not the author of their sin. And in fact, God restrained them. We talked about Psalm 76:10, the wrath of man shall praise thee, and the remainder shalt thou restrain. Much like he had restrained Abimelech from touching Sarah back in Genesis chapter 20, verses 3 to 7. And God speaks very plainly that he prevented that from happening. So the Bible teaches us that human beings, men and women, really do make choices and really do act. And when they act on their own desires. They act on their own emotions. They act on their own decisions and their own plans. They act out of their own motives. They do all of that. And the Bible teaches us that we are all accountable to God for the choices and actions that we make. Romans 14, verse 12 says, so then every one of us shall give account of himself to God. Paul says something similar, 2 Corinthians chapter 5 and verse 10, for we must all appear before the judgment seat of Christ, that everyone may receive the things done in his body according to that he hath done, whether it be good or bad. So the Bible teaches us that we are responsible and we are accountable for our actions, for our choices, for our decisions. The Bible also teaches us that God is perfectly just in his will and his sovereignty over all things. So Romans chapter 9, verses 19 says, thou wilt say, then say unto me, why doth he yet find fault? For who hath resisted his will? In other words, if God is sovereign over all, and it was his will for Joseph to end up in Egypt, then how could he hold the brothers responsible and accountable for their actions against him? Here's Paul's response. Nay, but O man, who art thou that repliest against God? Shall the thing formed say to him that formed it, why hast thou made me thus? Hath not the potter power over the clay of the same lump to make one vessel unto honor, another unto dishonor? What if God, willing to show his wrath and to make his power known, endured with much long suffering the vessels of wrath fitted to destruction? Sounds very much like what he said about the Amorites to Abraham. What if he did that, and that he might make known the riches of his glory on the vessels of mercy which he had afore prepared unto glory? So again, we are responsible. We are accountable to God for our decisions and for our actions and for our choices. We don't have knowledge of all of God's will. We don't have knowledge of all of God's purposes. And in any event, what all God is doing in and through that. We don't have knowledge of all of that. Our responsibility is not trying to figure out what God is doing or what purpose that he has in a particular event and try to bring that about. Our responsibility is to listen to his word and to obey it. And that's what we will be held accountable for before him. And especially his word that tells us, all human beings on earth, to repent of our sins and to believe on the Lord Jesus Christ alone for forgiveness of sins and for salvation, rescue from the wrath of God.